Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Imagine you graduated law school in 1968 and after 3 years in the Army began work as a lawyer. For more than 40 years, you've been a member of the bar in the relatively quiet state of Vermont, for about 20 of those as a judge. So how do you end up serving as an international judge ruling on war crimes in Kosovo? Vermont Justice Dean Pinellas is about to tell us. Dean, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be with you.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Well, I grew up in the North Shore of Massachusetts. Had a very good childhood. Went to the local public school until my last 2 years when my mom and dad sent me off to boarding school in Western Massachusetts. I think that set me on a track to achieve perhaps more than I might have otherwise if I'd gone to the local school. Went to college at Brown University in Providence, then went on to law school, and then into the Army for 3 years.
Okay, let's break that down a little bit. What'd your folks do?
Well, my dad had a very varied career. He started out as a chemist and then somehow morphed into an international business person. And he did consulting work with several foreign governments. He had an office in Seoul, Korea, Manila.
Did you go?
No, I did not go. I was doing my own career at the time.
Your mom a homemaker?
Primarily, although when we all became empty nesters, I guess you would say, or when they did, my mom went back to work.
And if I asked you before you left for college, what were your most important values, what would you have said?
Well, values, back in those days, I'm not sure I spent a whole lot of time thinking about values. I think I was probably thinking more about the next sports event that I was going to participate in. But
which were what?
I was on the track team. I was a high jumper.
You looked tall enough.
Right.
Did you learn anything from athletic competition that means anything to you in terms of your career?
Of course. Athletics, I think, teaches you collaborative work with other teammates. It teaches you discipline. It teaches you time management, because when you're on a sports team and on the road quite frequently, you have to learn how to do your schoolwork at the same time and so forth. So, yes, being a member of a sports team, I think, was a valuable contribution.
Why law school?
I think my personality was such that the law always attracted me, although I didn't realize it until probably my senior year of college. And I guess to be perfectly honest, it was during the height of the Vietnam War, and I'd had a college deferment, and I wanted to be a lawyer, but the double benefit of that was another deferment.
That would have been 65 when you're starting law school?
65 to 68. I graduated in 68.
Right.
68, of course, was one of the most tumultuous years in, I think, recent American history. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. The war was at its height. I took a month or so after graduating from law school to study for the bar exam. I took the bar exam, and I immediately went into the military. I jumped on a bus, and several hours later was dropped off at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and that began my military career.
And your military career, since you'd gone to law school, were you put in JAG?
That's another interesting twist of fate. I went through infantry training, including officer candidate school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I was commissioned as a second lieutenant infantry.
Then what happened?
Well, all of my classmates in my OCS class got orders for Vietnam, and I assumed that I was going to be among them. But it turned out that someone in a personnel office somewhere discovered that I had a law degree and was a member of the bar. And so I was assigned to a JAG unit.
JAG stands for?
Judge Advocate General. I was not a JAG officer. I was an infantry officer, but I was assigned to a JAG unit prosecuting military cases. And that's primarily what I did for my military career.
Okay, you're prosecuting military cases. What did you learn in that experience?
As a prosecutor of military cases at this time, my primary responsibility was prosecuting soldiers who had returned from Vietnam, who then went AWOL.
Hmm.
They would come back and have perhaps a couple of months left on their tour of duty, and they would say to themselves, "Look, I did my time. I was a combat soldier in Vietnam. What more does the government want from me? I'm going home." And a lot of these people were then rounded up and brought to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which was a central processing facility, and they would be prosecuted for AWOL was the typical offense. There were other offenses as well. There might be assaults or drug offenses and the like.
So what did you learn?
Well, I think I learned empathy. I think I learned that when you prosecute someone, you have to look not only at what they did, but at who they are and where they were coming from at the particular time. And I had a lot of sympathy for these folks because they did serve their country, most of them honorably, and then they got caught up in this web of circumstances.
Let me ask you this. Was it your experience that that sense of empathy and identification with the individual was typical or atypical of your peers, your military prosecutors?
A lot of the prosecutors that I worked with were JAG prosecutors who had gone through JAG school. And I think they may have had a slightly different orientation. They may have been perhaps a bit more prosecutorial, if you will. I'd have to think back and spend some time reviewing whom I worked with and so forth.
You're listening to Homeground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Vermont's Judge Dean Pinellas. What led to your becoming a judge in Vermont?
Well, among many legal jobs that I had after getting out of the Army, one of them was legal counsel to Governor Richard Snelling of Vermont, and this was in the early 1980s. And he announced that he was about to leave office, that he was not going to run for another term of governor, so I had to decide what I was going to do next in my career. And at the time, there was a vacancy on the Vermont judiciary, and I'd always been interested in perhaps being a judge.
And why?
I think it suited my personality better than being an advocate. When you're an advocate, you have to take one side of the story and you have to take it vigorously. You have to argue strongly for that particular point of view, whatever it might be. I see myself as someone who always likes to view both sides of the story, and I think that's a characteristic that you need when you're a judge. You have to listen to both sides of the story. You can't have preconceived notions. You can't be an advocate for one side or the other. You have to listen to both sides.
So from your resume, you served roughly 20 years as a judge in Vermont. How did the job compare with your expectations? Any surprises? Was it what you expected? What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I learned a lot about human nature. When you sit in a courtroom day after day, month after month, year after year, you see the whole human condition unfolding before your eyes. So I learned a lot about human nature. I learned a lot about myself and how I would deal with the stress of being on the bench, dealing with oftentimes life or death cases, cases that would have a lifetime effect for the people appearing before me. I learned how to deal with, mundane things such as time management and stress on the bench. It was a very rewarding career. A lot of people say, if you had to do your life over again, if you had to do your career over again, what would you do? And I would do it exactly the way I did it. It was a very rewarding legal career.
Okay, let's break those down. You learned a lot about human nature or the human condition. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that a lot of times people make bad decisions, but they're not necessarily bad people. A lot of people that came before me were from disadvantaged circumstances, and whether it was a robbery case or an assault case, there was a human being standing in front of me. That's not to say I was soft or necessarily sympathetic about what they did, but I always prided myself on being fair. I think I was fair, which is one of the key requirements of being a good judge, I think. And to be fair, you have to understand the people that you're actually dealing with. It's not a factory. It's not something that you can just stamp and move on to the next case. You have to look carefully at whom you're dealing with, and that includes the victims of cases. And I was oftentimes very solicitous to the victims of cases. I did criminal work primarily, but I also did civil work and family work. But looking at whom you have in front of you is very important.
Now, some people would say the law is the law, and the consequences for the victim or the nature of the accused, the sad story of the accused, is irrelevant to the disposition of the case. What do you say to that?
Well, the law is the law, and that's true, but the law has flexibility built into it, especially in the criminal context. For every particular crime, there is a range of punishment that can be imposed. So in my state, we have flexibility between imposing a lengthy jail sentence in a particular case or perhaps just probation. And it's up to the judge to exercise discretion in deciding what punishment within that broad range is appropriate. And that's where I think you have to look carefully at not only the circumstances of the case, the victim, but also the person standing before you as the defendant. Let me give you an example. I had a case one time where a young man, a high school student, a senior if I recall correctly, and his girlfriend were going to the senior prom. And they were driving to the prom. The young man was driving. He made the typical teenage mistake of consuming some alcohol. He was impaired, and he was involved in a serious accident. And his girlfriend, a very attractive young woman, was seriously injured. She suffered internal injuries. She suffered brain injuries. She suffered some disfigurement. It was a very, very sad case. And this young man, who I believe was an adult at the time, was charged as an adult. And the range of penalties were from 0 to 15 years in jail. And I had to decide what to do with this young man. And the young woman, fortunately, was making a fairly good recovery as the case was making its way towards trial. It never got to trial because we were able to work out a resolution of the case. And we did a lot of work on this case to try to come up with the right outcome. Obviously, drunk driving is a serious offense. It impacts a lot of people very seriously, and we have to take the case seriously. But we also have a young man just starting out in his life. He was a good student. He was a good athlete. He was a good kid. Everyone liked him. The question is, what do you do in a circumstance like this? You have a serious injury on the one hand. You have a case that isn't intentional. It's more negligent. This young man certainly didn't intend to seriously injure his girlfriend. So we spent a lot of time on that case trying to come up with the right solution. People can criticize this decision, and reasonable minds can differ about what to do. But what I decided to do was place him on probation. His dad had arranged to put him in a very strict prep school in Maine, and I made that a condition of probation, that he go to school, that he finish his studies, that he not consume any alcohol and drugs, that he report back periodically and the like. And I think the victim was satisfied with that, which was a good outcome.
So how does a judge from Vermont end up serving as an international criminal judge in relation to war crimes in Kosovo? First, maybe you can refresh our recollection. Kosovo was in the 90s, correct?
Well, the war in Kosovo was in the late 90s, 1998-99. It was headline news all over the world during that period of time. It sort of dropped off the radar now, but there's still a lot going on there.
Can you summarize the conflict for us?
Well, summarizing anything in the Balkans is difficult, and it depends on your point of view. But the generally accepted point of view is that the Serbians under Slobodan Milosevic in the late 1990s engaged in ethnic cleansing of the Albanian population in Kosovo.
Now, the Serbians were Christians and the Albanians were primarily Muslim.
That's correct. The Serbians are primarily Christian Orthodox, and the Kosovars are primarily Muslims, having been under the Ottoman Empire for roughly 500 years of their history.
It's been a while, but my recollection was there were very high-profile prosecutions of the Serbs, including Milosevic, who I think died before his trial was completed and he was sentenced. You come into the picture later. What's going on that brings you into this process of prosecuting war crimes?
Well, after I retired from the Vermont bench in 2005, I became actively involved in international rule of law work. I did a lot of short-time work in the former Soviet Union. I spent a year in the Republic of Georgia, and then I went to Kosovo. I liked the international work. There was a job opportunity as an international criminal judge in Kosovo. I applied for the job and was ultimately approved by the U.S. State Department and by the European Union, which administered the rule of law project in Kosovo.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Vermont Judge Dean Pinellas about his experience as a war crimes judge in Kosovo. By the time you got there, which I recall was 2011, Kosovo had declared itself an independent nation, correct, and was recognized by a majority of the world nations as such.
That's correct. I arrived in February 2011. Kosovo declared independence unilaterally in 2008, and it was recognized as an independent state by the United States and most of the Western states as well, but not by Serbia or Russia.
Okay, so what's going on in terms of why are there still war crimes prosecutions in Kosovo when you arrive?
Well, war crimes are very difficult cases, and there was a lot of chaos immediately after the war, and it has taken a number of years to sort out exactly what happened, who did what to whom, locate various witnesses. It's an extraordinarily time-consuming process with a lot of forensic responsibilities. It's very difficult to put together a war crimes case. It takes a long time, and that's especially true if the alleged defendant is a local war hero. Now, the court I was on in the institution I worked for, the European Union, prosecuted both Kosovars and Serbians.
Both sides of the conflict.
Both sides of the conflict. There was no distinction between one or the other. If a local Kosovar war hero committed a war crime, then he would be prosecuted just as a Serbian would be.
Let me just get this straight. A Kosovar is someone living in Kosovo and in the newly independent nation, is considered a hero by most of the population there because he fought on their side. Fair?
That's fair. The primary opposition to the Serbian troops under Slobodan Milosevic was the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA. And many of the people who are in high positions of government today in Kosovo were veterans of the KLA. And so many of them are viewed as war heroes.
Okay, and if I'm hearing you right, some of those individuals end up being charged as war criminals, correct?
That's correct. I had cases that involved KLA war heroes and cases that involved Serbians. There was no distinction. The local war heroes did not get a pass when it comes to war crimes cases.
Even though the trial is taking place under the jurisdiction of that nation, is that correct?
Well, the trial is taking place under the jurisdiction of the European Union rule of law mission.
All right, but it's in Kosovo?
It's in Kosovo. We use Kosovo law and, of course, international law as well. And in every case, we had a local judge sitting on the bench with us. And I should point out, and this is an important point, under Kosovo law, there are no jury trials. All of these cases were decided by a three-judge panel. Typically, there would be two internationals and one local judge sitting on the panel.
War crimes is a phrase. I remember descriptions of the Serbians slaughtering men, women, and children, taking them out and machine gunning them down. Tell us about the facts in one of the cases you handled with the alleged atrocities committed by the other side in response or whatever.
I had a case involving a KLA commander, a commander of the Kosovo Liberation Army, who became a very popular politician following the war. and he is also regarded as a war hero. However, he was alleged to be in charge of a detention facility that detained Serbian prisoners and Albanian collaborators. And at that detention facility, there was a guard, one of the local guards, who kept a secret diary. And in his diary, he recorded the comings and goings of every prisoner. No one else knew about this diary. It was a secret. And while he was a guard, he observed Serbian prisoners and Albanian collaborators being marched to a field a distance from the detention center and murdered. And he claimed that one of the Serbians was murdered with a scythe, a blow to the neck with a scythe. The war ended. He went about his business. But several years later, he began to fear for his life because he thought that people who may have perpetrated this crime became aware of his diary. And he felt fear for his own safety. So he eventually went to the police in 2009, described his story, disclosed his diary. And, of course, people were skeptical. And this detention camp was allegedly, as I said, under the auspices of a KLA commander and presently a politician.
That guy turns out to be the accused?
Yes.
His name?
Fatmir Limaj.
So now I interrupted you. What happens to the guy with the diary?
Well, the guy with the diary went to the police. He told a story, and, of course, people were skeptical. So there was a forensics team that went to the site, and they dug up the spot where this witness said the bodies were buried. And indeed, the bodies were buried there. And one of the corpses had evidence of a blow to the neck consistent with a blow from a scythe. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the scythe was found in the grave. So it appeared to the police at this point that this man was credible, that the story he was telling was true. In the process of the prosecutor developing the case, this guard, this witness, gave detailed testimony under oath. And as a result of the forensic evidence at the gravesite and this man's testimony, the international prosecutor brought charges against this this war hero and nine other former KLA members.
And you're on the judge panel.
I'm on the judge panel. I'm one of the three judges on the panel. And the case was making its way towards trial. The guard, the witness, who was then known as Witness X, was in the witness protection program. And about 2 weeks before trial, we received an urgent message that Witness X, the key witness in the case, the only witness who could name names, was found hanged in a park in Duisburg, Germany. And
Interesting coincidence.
Interesting coincidence, indeed.
Let me ask you this now. So you have a dead witness, can't testify at trial. It's a fundamental legal issue because he can't be cross-examined by the defense. You have a three-judge panel. You have to decide whether the testimony is admissible. What happened?
That was the key legal issue. If the testimony was admissible, then the trial would go forward. If the testimony was inadmissible, then the defendants would have to be found not guilty. This was a very difficult issue for the three of us on the panel, and we had several days of hearings to get the views of all the lawyers in the case, and we couldn't come to an agreement. Two of the judges felt that the evidence was inadmissible. On the other hand, based on my legal research under Kosovo law and international law, I believe the testimony was admissible, and we couldn't come to agreement, but because it was a 2-3 vote, the defendants were found not guilty. However, the story doesn't end there. The prosecutor appealed the finding of not guilty, and the Kosovo Supreme Court reversed that finding, and in so doing, I guess I'm proud to say, adopted the reasoning in my opinion.
So the case went forward?
Yes. It was a 2-1 opinion.
So your position won on appeal, and then what happened?
Well, the case went back for a retrial, and it was tried before a different panel of judges. I'd returned to the United States at this time, and proceedings are ongoing. The case has not been finally resolved.
Now, trying someone in a foreign country who's considered a war hero seems to me to be a fundamental challenge to the idea of neutrality. Did you feel pressure? Was there tangible pressure on you as a judge? And if so, how was it manifested?
Well, the courtroom was always filled with supporters of the defendants. And the media was always present outside of the courtroom. TV cameras were always running out on the street. And there was a lot of pressure on the judiciary. The courtroom was always staffed with a SWAT team carrying automatic weapons in case there was a problem in the courtroom. Fortunately, there never was. In this particular case I'm describing, I had to travel back and forth to the courthouse in an armored vehicle, and I had to have bulletproof and a bombproof door installed in my apartment because of the potential for flare-up that might be directed at one of the judges on this case. Fortunately, nothing ever happened.
But let me just jump in. It happened in the sense that you were living under these conditions, which reinforces in the most vivid terms your life is in jeopardy. How did it make you feel?
I never felt personally in jeopardy. I mean, it was a theoretical threat, which I took seriously, and I was very circumspect during that period of time to make sure that there was nothing untoward going on that might affect me or my wife or my dog. But things turned out fairly well, and after that case, I no longer had to go to my work site in an armored vehicle, which was a relief. So there was a period of time that was quite stressful. Nothing serious happened, I think primarily because this man ended up being acquitted, at least at the trial level, and then I went on to other cases.
One lesson that might be derived from your experience is it's tough to try war heroes on their own turf. What do you bring back home? You were here as an American judge for more than 20 years. What would you say to the American people about our system of justice?
Having experienced up close another system of justice, I have to say that I'm quite proud with the system we have. Our system certainly is not foolproof by any means, and it has many flaws, but I think we have, over the last 220-plus years or so, developed a system that most people have confidence in, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of a legitimate, mature judiciary is that people have confidence in the outcome.
When they have confidence in the outcome, the implication is they have confidence in the impartiality of the judge. Fair?
Impartiality of the judge, the prosecutor, the jury, and all of the other key participants in the process, and you have to have confidence in all of them to have a fair and mature judiciary.
Judge Dean Pinellas, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Very nice to be with you, Brian.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.